from GPB News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today we look at arguably the most efficient mode of transportation, the bicycle.
My bike!
Where's my bike?
Paging Mr. Herman. Mr. Pee-wee Herman.
I found my bike!
Atlanta rolled out its own version of bike share this year. We'll take a look at what the city's doing to make its streets more bike-friendly. First, though, we talked this week about a new study that says about half of Americans will not get flu shots this year. Robert Bednarczyk is a professor of public health at Emory University, and he told us the flu shot is important, but it won't protect you against every sickness.
The big problem is that when we give the influenza vaccine over the course of the influenza season, that's not the only disease that's circulating. And there's a lot of other viruses that can cause other similar types of illness that are happening at that same time.
We asked you if you'd gotten your flu shot or you plan to do so, and we got this comment from listener Maurice Tate.
I don't normally take it. I haven't taken it for over 12 years because I take a lot of vitamins. And since I've been taking my vitamins, I haven't had the flu. Before taking vitamins, I used to take the flu shots, and I still used to get the flu.
You can always call us and leave a message like Maurice did. It's 404-500-9457. We are also on Twitter, at OST Talk, or post on Facebook. Remember, we might feature your comment on the show. By all accounts, Atlanta's Fox Theater should not exist anymore. The historic movie palace opened Christmas Day of 1929. It nearly folded several times, narrowly dodged a date with a wrecking ball, and survived a potentially fatal fire. But 87 years later, the theater's thriving. And to mark its anniversary, a new GPB documentary will premiere Christmas night at 7 o'clock. It's called The Legend Lives On, Atlanta's Fox Theater. And we have with us the president and CEO of the Fox, Alan Vella.
Good morning. Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What's your favorite story to tell about the Fox when people ask you?
I think my favorite story is that everybody in Atlanta has a Fox story. So I think it's one of those
places. That means you do.
Well, yeah, I do.
So what's your Fox story?
Well, I think my favorite story, I think it was the first time I came to the Fox with my family. I had moved here from Texas to take the job, and my daughter was three, and we went to the movies, went to the Coca-Cola film series, and we went up into the balcony, and my daughter had never been in the theater before, and she was looking around, and I said something about being indoors, and she said, "No, Daddy, we are outside. Look at the stars." And so I couldn't quite convince my three-year-old that we are actually inside, but that's probably one of my favorite family stories.
You're correct, and one thing that this documentary makes very clear is that everybody here, even people all throughout Georgia, seem to have at least one fond memory of the Fox. Here are some visitors who are featured in the documentary.
I like to look at everything because it's really fancy, especially inside the theaters because it kind of looks like a castle.
The first memory that I have was coming to see the Nutcracker. I think I was maybe about four or five, and I remember all of the lights and just how magical it felt.
I've been coming here forever. My family's here from Atlanta. My brother proposed to his wife at Romeo and Juliet, the same one. So this place has some roots.
So, I mentioned that the Fox Theater at this point should not have existed. I mean, literally, the stock market crashed in 1929 within days of it opening, and William Fox went bankrupt. But I wonder if you have ideas on why it has made it through, because there have been a number of beautiful buildings, incredible architectural gems around the country that have closed anyway. So what has kept the Fox open?
Well, I think Atlanta kind of got to the point where they saw so many of their historic structures and significant atmospheric theaters be torn down. And I think finally Atlanta maybe just said, no, enough is enough. And I think because the Fox had so many memories and so many personal connections that finally the citizens said, you know, we can't let that happen.
And that happened in the 1970s. That's when at the time, Southern Bell wanted to tear down the Fox and build their headquarters there. And I want to play a comment from former Atlanta Mayor Maynard Jackson. This is from a 2003 interview he did shortly before his death. And this is where he's talking about how surprised he was that anyone would actually want to tear down the Fox.
I was absolutely horrified. It was incredible, unbelievable that anybody would even consider doing that. It was also sheer folly to think that we would ever issue the demolition permit.
But what do you hear from people that drives that connection. Because look, again, there are many efforts in many cities to save historic structures. And frankly, Atlanta has not gotten over its addiction to tearing down its old buildings. So what sort of drives that passion for people for this one, do you think?
Well, I think there's very few structures quite like this, right? I mean, it's an atmospheric theater, and it's a theater that has survived all the different changes within the city, people leaving the city, people returning to the city, different forms of entertainment. I mean, we're tearing down a football stadium that's only 15 years old. And now we have an 87-year-old theater that literally has been unchanged for all that time. And I honestly just think that it's that people have a special, special connection with that venue that they don't have with any other venue in town.
It is the Fox Theater, among many things, is false in many ways. It's an illusion, right?
Right.
I mean, it's made to look like it's a bunch of different buildings, but it's not. It's one great big one, as your daughter pointed out quite early on.
Right.
It's made to look like it's outside. A lot of stuff everywhere is Trump, right? It's not what it appears.
Correct.
And the Fox has maintained that and preserved it. What do you like about that, the sort of illusion portion of
Well,
the
it's
Fox?
Theater magic, right? And then the architect and the Shriners who built the building really wanted to transform you before the show started, right? So they wanted you to come into the building and be in a different world, in a different place, and for you to forget your troubles and the things that are on your mind and sit back and enjoy the surroundings and then enjoy the presentation on stage. So I think that's what's so unique about it.
So the moment you walk in, you're already in a fantasy.
You're being enveloped in this fantasy immediately.
It seems to work in some ways. Let's hear this comment from Mike Mills. He was a bassist many people know for the group REM. And he explains why musicians like to play there.
Nobody plays poorly here. I've never seen a bad show. I think there's something about this place, and there's something about how it makes the crowd happy to be here. And if the crowd's happy, usually the band's happy. And that give and take is what produces a good show.
The stage itself, if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Alan Vella. He is the president and CEO of the Fox. And we're talking about a new documentary from GPB called The Legend Lives On, Atlanta's Fox Theater. It'll premiere on Christmas night. So one of the things which is sort of distinctive about the Fox is the shape of the stage. It's very wide, like 135 feet. And please correct me if I'm getting this wrong. You're the expert. But it's shallow.
Correct.
How does that change the setup for shows that come through and even bands?
It's problematic. Bands, not so much, but large Broadway shows. Some of the large Broadway shows will travel in 20 to 25 semis. So that's a lot of gear and a lot of equipment we have to get in the building. Luckily, it is approximately 130 feet wall to wall, about 70 foot across in the proscenium opening, but only 32 feet deep. So the interesting thing
that's
about—
It's very shallow for us.
It's
for
very
a stage.
Shallow. But the thing that Atlantans should know is that many shows that hit the road, that travel the country, are built for our stage because we're one of the smallest stages on tour in North America. So they build it and design it so it could be adapted to our depth. Because
you guys are so difficult.
Well, because we're so difficult. No, but really because the Atlanta audiences come out. And we have some of the highest record grosses of all of touring Broadway here in Atlanta. So Book of Mormon, Wicked, many of those shows.
You guys are getting Hamilton.
Yeah, we're getting Hamilton in May of 18. So those shows are actually built so they can accommodate our stage specifications.
And I should say that you guys have operated, had an operating surplus since 1975.
Approximately, yes.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Depending on how you view those numbers. It appears to me, and again, I'm not an expert, you are, but it appears to me that one of the ways that the Fox survived was because they weren't elitist. They became creative from the very beginning on how to bring in lots of money. Let's hear a comment here from Alex Cooley. He was a music promoter. He died last year. He organized midnight concerts at the Fox to try and bring in younger people. And he remembers doing this at a time when the Fox was showing some really, really bad movies.
When the movie was over, we had to clear the house. And by that time, we had upwards of 4,000 people. People wanted to come to the Fox. They wanted to have the rock experience. We had good talent. It was a nightmare trying to switch it over and do it everything, but I was determined to do it.
So tell me a little bit about the diversity of events that happen at the Fox. And
sure.
And it I mean, again, you can have in a building like that, which was extraordinarily expensive at the time that it was built, you can say, look, we only want Yo-Yo Ma playing here, right? We only want this higher class of talent. Why did the Fox differ from that?
Well, that's not who we are. Our mission is to preserve and share. So our board insists that we share the theater with all of Georgia, especially all of Atlanta, every demographic we can. The only challenge is we have to balance that with the cost of doing business. But it's our intention to have a really diverse entertainment programming portfolio. So everything from Alvin Ailey to Widespread Panic, Atlanta Ballet, you name it. So
I saw Prince's, his last concerts were here
in
Atlanta.
Yeah, that was very special. And then we love having the children in the building too, because we feel that to have Atlanta's children come through the building, it gives them a special attachment and memory, you know, of the theater. So they may be around to help protect us in the future. But it's our desire to have every Atlantan come and visit the Fox Theater at least once a year.
Will the Fox ever stop playing movies? It started as a movie palace. William Fox was a movie person.
Right.
Will it ever stop playing actual films?
I don't think so. I think, we are a movie palace first and foremost. We always try to honor that heritage. We don't make money on movies, but what we try to do is give people an inexpensive opportunity to come and enjoy the Fox. And then we'll play real film, not just digital. And we love that.
Yeah, and here's Scott Hardin speaking of that. He's a projectionist at the theater.
Do I think film will ever go away completely? At this venue, we're going to try to preserve it as long as we can and the ability to show it. It moves you in a way that you're not going to be moved viewing the same content on a smaller screen with just earbuds in place.
So what does the future hold for the Fox? What might be the next sort of creative way that the Fox keeps its operating surplus?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I think we're going to continue to be in tune with our customers, and we seem to ebb and flow with what the needs of Atlanta are. So, your reference to Alex Cooley, so back in the 70s and 80s, Alex brought great rock music to our building, and it helped us really survive and help save us. And now, obviously, we have a very strong Broadway diet. We'll do 12 to 14 weeks of Broadway every year. And then you just never know what's around the corner. You know, it could be YouTube stars like Dan and Phil, or it could be obviously more Broadway, more music. But I think, you know, as long as we keep all of Atlanta visiting us, I think that's what will help us survive.
We've got about a minute left. So, and I know that the party line is that there's no bad seat in the Fox, but honestly, what's the best place to sit to watch a show in the Fox?
I think it depends on the show. I love sitting upstairs for movies.
In the balcony,
in the loge. Actually, the higher seats in the balcony, preferably. And I think that's also the best place to hear the organ. So when the organ's playing for Broadway or prior to movies, it's a fullness of sound. And then I think for rock and roll and some of the Broadway shows, I prefer to sit on the floor, obviously center, you know, because then you really kind of get the image of the stage, what either the lighting designer or the set designer had in mind for you to see. And then you don't see any of the markings on the floor people to take their position.
That's Alan Vella. He's the president and CEO of the Fox Theater in Atlanta. A new documentary about the Fox premieres Christmas night at 7 o'clock on GPB TV. Alan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
The Fox opened in 1929, and some say a few of the millions who passed through those doors still remain. The theater hosts ghost tours each year, and we sent producer Sean Powers to learn about the spirits that refuse to leave even after the curtain comes down.
If you have a ghost app on your phone, go ahead and turn it on. If you see it working, don't tell me till the end of the tour. My name is Anna Seaton, and I'm a tour guide at the Fox Theater. That's the organist. You're gonna hear strange noises coming from in there. There really is a live person at the organ. All right, so let's start with the beginning of what was here with the property. Now, I'm not gonna go too far back. I'm gonna go to the Civil War. 1863 to 1864, this was Fortification K. We had 25 fortification areas in Atlanta to protect us. So if there's Civil War history here, then that means there's going to be Civil War death here. We're going to probably have some ghosts from that time period, and we do. We have a Confederate soldier that sometime is seen in one of the upper windows when people are out on the street and happen to look up. Instead of lingering in the light of the lobby, let's go down where there's dark places to explore.
Is she not
This elevator is original to the Fox Theater, 1929. It's in Otis, and it was the first automated elevator in Atlanta. Now, I had heard that there was a ghost that rode on the elevator we just rode on, and somebody told me 6th floor, somebody told me 7th floor, but you press a button to a floor and it goes to one of those 2 floors. That's kind of a curious thing, and that it smells like roses. And I have no experience with that, and I make it a policy not to talk about the ghosts around the elevators or on the elevators, because I've had them pull pranks on me. Either that or it's a mechanical malfunction that happened 4 times in a row, you know? This is the freight elevator. Everything that's going on the stage that comes off the alley is going on this elevator. It jiggles a little when it starts connecting. When we get up to the top, we're going to go off at stage level. So I want to tell you what to expect. When the theater is empty, we're not doing a show, it's considered to be dark. When it's dark, there's a ghost light on the edge of the stage so nobody falls off. There's nobody here, but we leave a light on anyway. Now, the story behind that is you don't want a ghost to take ownership of the theater and start doing malicious things. And so you have a ghost light there to tell him it's not okay. You also have a ghost light there on other theories to show them where they can perform. My favorite recommendation on a ghost light is to have it there so I don't see them perform.
Okay. Oh my gosh.
These are your organ pipes on either side. Bob Van Kamp's ashes are in there. They're in an urn.
Bob Van Kamp played organ at the Fox Theater for years. He mentored current Fox Theater organist Rick McGee. Sean found McGee in the theater in front of his organ, and McGee says he remembers Bob Van Kamp very well.
I would work with Bob, and he'd show me different registrations and things that he would do, and I would incorporate that. You could sit and listen to him play for hours, and your ears didn't get weary. I mean, he was first the music and then the instrument. And so he's the one I patterned most of my playing after because he's the one I grew up listening to. I haven't seen Bob here. I feel like I talk to him all the time, you know. And a lot of times when I play things, I'm sure he's up there listening, going, can feel him helping you along. And it's just fine, you know.
When you eventually pass on, would you ever want to haunt the Fox Theater?
Well, I sincerely hope that maybe I can join Bob and some of them here, and, you know, maybe we'll start a whole club. Yeah. But, oh, yeah, I have no problems hanging around. I mean, it's fun to stay here and mess with folks.
Our thanks to the Fox Theater for the haunted tour. For a look back at the Fox Theater's long history, visit gpbnews.org. . 2016 has been a productive year for making Atlanta more bicycle-friendly. Just last fall, the city hired Becky Katz as its first chief bicycle officer. Her job is to make Atlanta a safe place to ride bikes, and that's a lot. She joins me now. Hi, Becky.
Hi.
This summer, the city also rolled out its own version of Bike Share. Bikes are now available to everybody stationed throughout the city, and you rent the bike at one place, and then you drop it off at another one, hopefully close to your destination. Kimberly Jones is the manager of marketing and community outreach for Relay. That's what we call our Bike Share. Hi, Kimberly.
Hello.
And also with us to talk more of a big picture is Alex Karner, professor of city and regional planning at Georgia Tech. Hi, Alex.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so of the three of you, who biked here?
I did. It's Becky. Becky and Kimberly.
And Alex, you biked also?
I recently injured my thumb.
I see that.
So I took a lift here.
Right. Yeah. Okay. It's cold out, but you guys obviously feel safe biking.
Yes.
So I actually combined a MARTA trip and bike trip. I live about 5 miles from here, so I got on at the West End MARTA station and then rode down 10th Street, which honestly, not that comfortable to ride on. You know, you have to go over the highway ramps, but generally made it here safe and happy to be here.
Alex, what does it take when you're talking about city planning? What is involved in making a city bike friendly? Is it always dedicated bike lanes?
Not necessarily. I mean, the research is pretty clear on one point, that the best way to make cycling safer is to have more people cycling, right? So a well-connected, integrated infrastructure system, including on-street bike lanes, shared-use trails, are super important. Also important are things like bike parking, okay? Kind of like less sexier things like bike outreach and communication, so folks kind of know what they need to do to feel safe
on
the road.
What is bike outreach?
So just sort of the idea that there are lots of folks that would like to bike. They're interested in biking, but they feel unsafe. So we want to have sort of like educational programs for folks that can come and kind of learn the ropes, learn what they need to do to be an effective kind of urban cyclist.
Okay. We're going to get to Timberley in a moment to talk about bike share. But first, Becky, I'm one of those people. I'm a very avid cyclist. I've spent 2 years of my life using a bike only for my primary mode of transportation, but I feel unsafe because every time I ride my bike, there's cars getting really close to me and they yell at me out their windows. Educate me on whether it's safe or not for me to ride.
So I think the big part of what the city's movement is to create safer corridors generally for all modes. We have a lot of infrastructure projects lined up through the Renew Atlanta Bond Program and through T-SPLOST, both there to create safer corridors for all modes, which to me is the main part of my job, which is to ensure that as those projects roll out, that bikes are considered and are given space when they need space and our traffic calming is involved and clearing up any sort of confusion there is on the roads. And then I would also encourage you to get involved in things like Atlanta Bicycle Coalition's Urban Confidence Rides and figuring out...
Urban Confidence Rides. Mm-hmm. And those are led by guides, I guess, that are just trying to prove that that you won't die if you ride a bike.
Yeah, and I think that's what Alex was highlighting about that outreach. There's lots of community rides, group rides to go on. Relay Bike Share has 101 classes. And finding places that you do feel comfortable, because even transforming some of your trips to bikes, not 100%, is an important aspect of the changing culture of Atlanta.
Okay, so Timberley, that's a little different. Getting people who live here to ride their own bike is different than your mission of a bike share, is it not?
A little bit. We still want to create the excitement around riding a bike, and then the bike share gives people access. So people that haven't used their bike because they had a flat and didn't know how to get it fixed, or a bike just is sitting in the corner of your garage. So this gives you a reason, hey, there's a bike here. Let me just hop on a bike to see how I feel and get back in the swing of things.
How many relay stations are there?
There are 22 relay stations right now.
Inside the city limits of Atlanta?
Yes.
And how many are you hoping to get?
We're hoping to branch up as much as possible. By the spring 2017, we're going to expand to 500 bikes. So ideally, we try to keep around 8 or so bikes at each station. It just depends on the traffic and everything. So mostly, we're going to ramp up to 500 bikes. So we're going to distribute them throughout the city.
Walk me through a relay transaction. I walk up. I see a relay station there. There's a couple bikes there for me to use. What happened? What do I do?
Hopefully, you get excited and you say, I want to ride. And then you pull out your phone and you have to download the Social Bicycles app on your Google Play or in the App Store on your iPhone. And then once you download that, you enter your credit card information, your name, your email, you get a confirmation email, and then your account is set up. And then you either reserve right from the bike or you can reserve from the app on your phone. So the app finds the closest bikes close to your location. It has GPS, and each bike has a GPS on it. So if a bike is close to you, you pull up the app, it'll show in the app.
And then it'll also show me where the closest station is to my destination.
Yes.
So, Alex, what is the benefits? Why would a city invest in something like this as opposed to investing in more of the streets, which people complain have potholes? Why aren't we spending it there?
I think that's the exact right question to be asking. And I think that doing a kind of deeper commitment to bike share while I'm fully in support, it kind of risks putting the cart before the horse a little bit. We don't have a very well-integrated, well-connected network of bike infrastructure in the city of Atlanta. So just putting a bike share system, it kind of lowers the barrier. It says, hey, if you don't have a bike, here's a bike. But if folks don't feel like they can get where they need to go safely, they're not necessarily going to jump on it. So it's not clear to me that this is the best way to be spending all of our transportation resources, which we're not, but in the kind of competition for scarce funds, what should we be spending our money on? Where are we going to get the most bang for the buck?
And so better from a city planning standpoint? What might be, to your mind, more effective to get the city ready for that?
Yeah, so I kind of said this before, but things like just basic bike infrastructure. You know, it costs about $100,000 per mile to do an on-street bike lane. So for the same amount of money that we're going to be spending from the T-SPLOST on relay bikes, about $3 million, we could get about 30 miles of bike lanes on the street, right? That's a big deal. Bike parking, anyone that's biked in Atlanta knows that it's a real pain to try to find somewhere to park your bike.
It is. Even
bike
the businesses parking. Don't have yeah. bike
Think,
parking.
For sure. So we have minimum parking requirements for businesses for cars. Why not have minimum parking requirements for bikes? Just
we
put
do.
A couple bike posts.
Becky, you wanted to answer that?
Yeah. I actually I'm proud to say that, you know, the first 500 bikes are not supported through city funds, but actually through private investment. And we had the pleasure of announcing the first big supporting sponsor, Georgia's Own Credit Union, which is a statewide credit union. So we're really excited about that. But what Alex is talking about is that we have committed to funding a larger expansion of bike share. Through T-Splos, $3 million, which
I want to pause for just one second because we're saying T-Splos a lot. I want to make sure everyone's with us. T-Splos stands for Transportation Special Purpose Local Option Sales Tax.
Good job.
Basically, it's something that people vote for in a referendum, and they say, yes, we are willing to pay this extra tax in order to pay for transportation improvements. Okay, sorry, continue.
Yeah, and bike share is a very, very small portion of that tax. So it's estimated about a $3 million five-year tax revenue. And many of the projects on the T-Splos list focus on exactly what Alex is highlighting, which is better trail system, more on-street bike lanes, more complete streets, better pedestrian sidewalks, pedestrian infrastructure, and roadway improvements. So I would push back and say that, you know, the bike share system helps our goals with bike infrastructure, because bike infrastructure actually creates a lot of spirited conversations.
Arguments.
You know, people are wary of major roadway change. They don't know how it's going to affect their lives. They're nervous. They don't want their commute times to be affected, right? And so,
right, and some of the streets are quite narrow, and and frankly, there's a lot of streets that don't even have sidewalks.
Yeah, and so, you know, it creates, and so progress on transportation projects, especially in the bike space, need a lot of well-thought-out community engagement, education, and bike share is so positive. People love it, and people think it's cool, and it's great, and they can try out biking. And so it's kind of...
What is out biking?
Try out biking. Like
they can
try it out, you know?
I thought that was like some really cool, hip kind of biking I didn't know about.
Very hip. Don't worry.
Timberly, was this a difficult sell to convince city leaders and others to create a bike share program? Was that difficult?
Well, initially, I wasn't involved in that process. I got on board after the city leaders were already convinced that we would have
you
bike share.
You avoided that hole.
Yes, I did. But I was a cyclist. I've been cycling Atlanta for at least a year and a half now. And I saw the project like they were talking about it. So, of course, from my view, I was excited for it to come to town. So
do you? You must be proselytizing everywhere. You go for coffee and you tell people to try out bike share, right?
Yes. And I ride bike share.
Give me an example of that sell. What's your elevator pitch to people?
Well, it depends on the person. So I'm not the person that will try and get you to just not use a bike to go for your transportation. I try to sell the fun and the activity. Like, people riding a bike forget that we're busy. We forget the feeling of having fun, enjoying life on the bike when we were children. Like, it's a carefree lifestyle, and we forget how that feels. So I just tell people, when's the last time you rode a bike? And, oh, it's been years, girl. Go and try the bike out. Take it down the street when we have, like, our urban confidence classes and stuff like that, just to get a feel. And then just the excitement. They just keep riding and riding and riding. So it's not really a sell. It's just reminding people of how they felt when they were young, free, and just, you know, living stress-free and just enjoying life.
Alex, is there an inherent benefit to a city that has a good population of bike riders?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that we talk about most often in the planning profession are the health benefits, right? It's basic. More physical activity equals better health outcomes. Lower air quality, better air quality is a huge deal as well. And less traffic congestion. I mean, what can be better than that? People in the city of Atlanta say, oh, you know, why are we spending any money on bicyclists at all? They're only 1% of commuters right now. Well, let me tell you, if you can increase that share to 5% or 6%, the benefits,
the
benefits, yeah, the number of cars off the road is huge. And you really start to see this kind of critical mass of cyclists, and you get this virtuous cycle where more cyclists make safer cycling and build support for further development of cycling infrastructure. It's really a beautiful thing. Been to a city where
this works.
Where it works.
Alex Karner is a professor of city and regional planning at Georgia Tech. We also spoke with Becky Katz, who is Atlanta's chief bicycle officer. And also with us was Timberly Jones, manager of community outreach for Atlanta's Bike Chair. It's a program that's called Relay. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We were planning to talk to George Turner today. He's Atlanta's police chief, but he announced last month he will retire before the end of the year. Unfortunately, Mr. Turner had a last-minute conflict. So instead, we revisit a great conversation we had about another important Georgian, Atlanta attorney Donald Hollowell. Hollowell was called Mr. Civil Rights. He represented Martin Luther King Jr. in court, and he argued the case that resulted in the desegregation of the University of Georgia. But Maurice Daniels says there's much more to Hollowell's legacy than just a highway named after him in Atlanta. Daniels is the former dean of the University of Georgia's School of Social Work. He wrote a book and produced a documentary on Donald Hollowell, and he joined me to talk about Hollowell's legacy.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining me. I wanted to start off our conversation by playing you a comment from Lonnie King. Lonnie King was the chair of the Atlanta student movement, and Donald Hollowell gave him and the student movement legal counsel. And we asked Lonnie King about Hollowell's legacy. Take a listen.
Mr. Hollowell is possibly one of the most unsung heroes of the civil rights movement. We publicize a lot of the efforts of people who were leading marches and what have you. But the civil rights lawyers, whereas they did not necessarily march, they played a tremendous role, and in my opinion, as equally effective role as those of us who were out marching.
I wonder what you make of that, whether or not the attorneys representing the movement in court played an equally important role to the people who were leading marches.
I would absolutely agree with Mr. King. The attorneys played a pivotal role in the civil rights movement and in the black freedom struggle and helping to make democracy more of a reality for all Georgians in this case, and certainly all Americans. Without their work, certainly the progress would not have been made, certainly in the time frame in which much of the progress was made. If we look at even pivotal, famous events in the civil rights movement, such as the Montgomery bus boycott. We often think of that boycott and we think of the civil rights activists who were involved. But in addition to those activists who were involved in marches and in protests and in boycotts, the lawyers were also involved in the courtroom. In fact, Fred Gray, who is a very gifted attorney in the state of Alabama and the city of Montgomery, played a very pivotal role in that whole movement to help basically dismantle the discrimination in which the protesters were facing related to the buses in Montgomery. So Thurgood Marshall and NAACP Defense Fund also played a pivotal role in the Montgomery bus boycott. But often we chronicle and we see the headlines regarding the protests and the activists who are involved, who play a significant role in terms of bringing about social change, but equally important are the roles of the, or were the roles of attorneys and lawyers who also made a tremendous difference.
Well, to that end, I wanted to then play you a comment from Julian Bond, a founding member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And here he is. He's been charged at this point. He's recounting in a moment when he was charged for protesting outside of Atlanta City Hall. And Donald Hollowell was one of the lawyers representing him.
The judge says to me, "How do you plead?" Well, I was stunned. How do I plead? I turned to Don Hollowell. And he said in this stage whisper, I'm sure could be heard throughout the whole classroom, he said, "Not guilty, you fool." And I said, "Not guilty."
To what extent, Maurice, do you think that many of these activists weren't prepared for the legal end of their struggle? It seems in many cases to have taken them off guard when they were charged and did have to enter courtrooms.
Well, I believe that, again, going back to the important role of the lawyers, and in Mr. Hollowell's case, in addition to working to dismantle state-sanctioned segregation or discrimination in the courtroom, he also played a pivotal role representing civil rights activists. And you are correct. In some cases, activists who were arrested had not planned, so to speak, a strategy in terms of how they were going to deal with the legal difficulties and apparatus and challenges in which they faced in terms of the arrests and their incarceration. And certainly it was individuals such as Mr. Hollowell and many others, lawyers, who helped them to develop strategies to deal with that aspect of the civil rights movement.
We mentioned earlier the case that led to the desegregation of the Georgia State College of Business. There was a federal injunction that he won, and the University of Georgia as well. But he worked on desegregation in a number of places. Can you tell me about the case against the Atlanta airport, the facilities there, and how he won desegregation there?
That was one of the, you mentioned earlier that Mr. Hollowell is one of the unsung civil rights activists. That is a pivotal case that he won that certainly helped to change the landscape within our state, if not this region, if not our nation. When you think about the economic engine and how important the Atlanta Airport is to the city of Atlanta, to this region, to our state, and to our nation, Mr. Hollowell represented a man by the name of H.D. Koch from Birmingham, Alabama, who was traveling through Atlanta, had a connecting flight in Atlanta. Delta Airlines provided meal tickets to all of its passengers. Mr. Koch went into the restaurant, only African American who was on the flight. Mr. Koch was not allowed to sit in the dining room with the other white passengers, but was relegated to eat in a corner or in the kitchen. And Mr. Hollowell represented him, won a federal court case, which basically prohibited the Atlanta airport and the city of Atlanta from further discrimination at its airport terminal. And that case certainly was pivotal in terms of desegregating public facilities and treating individuals on an equal basis at the airport. So a very important case, and that case was Ms. Hollowell won in 1961, with the help, I might add, of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
You've spent many years looking into Donald Hollowell's legacy and writing about him. How did he win these cases? What made him successful?
Well, I think number one, he was well prepared. Number two, he had from interviewing a number of his contemporaries, lawyers, judges, and even those individuals who he represented, such as Lonnie King and Julian Bond. He also had some, in addition to being well prepared, he just had some natural abilities. He was articulate. He was well spoken. He was a master of the King's English, and then beyond that, he was dedicated and committed to the cause of social justice, and was very effective in the courtroom. And he also had an opportunity to work with a number of individuals who were civil rights activists who supported the cause, and also a number of lawyers who teamed with him, including Thurgood Marshall. In fact, he was often referred to as Thurgood Marshall's man in Georgia. He was sort of the chief local counsel on most of the civil rights cases in the state of Georgia between 1952 and 1967, when he actually went to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission as regional director.
Well, I wanted to play you another comment from Lonnie King when we spoke to him. And he refers to Donald Hollowell as an important mentor for him. But he's talking about what Donald Hollowell was like in the courtroom. Take a listen.
In the South, Don Hollowell was the man. And that included all of the South. He knew the law. He was especially adept at cutting through the Southern BS in these courtrooms and getting us down to the nub of the argument.
I wonder, what do you think he means there, cutting through the Southern BS and getting down to the nub?
I believe there was a number of superficial, I shouldn't say I believe, there were a number of, there was a lot of superficiality regarding state-sanctioned laws, which were in violation of the Constitution of the United States. Mr. Hollowell knew the law very well. He knew the Constitution very well, and he utilized his legal training and his aptitude basically to dismantle those dragons that continued to relegate, in this case, African Americans to second-class citizenship. And he won a number of cases. You mentioned the desegregation of the University of Georgia, the federal injunction against the Georgia State College of Business, which is now Georgia State University. But Mr. Hollowell went into courtrooms throughout our state and won the rights for African Americans to be able to go to school, the rights for African Americans to be able to ride on buses without being relegated to seats on the back of the bus. He won a federal case in Macon. He won a federal case in Augusta, which desegregated the public transit systems in those cities. He won cases desegregating public schools in Savannah. He won a case desegregating public schools in Brunswick. He won a case desegregating public schools in Macon and Bibb County. So the list goes on. So he, as Mr. King indicated, was the man in dismantling this system of state-sanctioned segregation within Georgia.
I mean, you met him, though. What was he like as a person? What did you think of him as a guy?
Oh, wow. He was exception of my dad and perhaps my uncles. He was clearly the most dynamic man I ever had an opportunity to meet. He had a presence about him which is very difficult to describe, but he walked in a room and he just kind of filled up the room with his presence, and he walked with dignity. And then when he spoke, he spoke with such authority, a man who, as Julian Bond has often said, enunciated every syllable in every word. So he was just an amazing man. And then the other thing that I remember about him is that when you had an opportunity to engage with him, he made you feel as though you were the only person within the universe. And he was a man of great humility. I recall my first time meeting him and remember him indicating to me how honored he was and how humble he was to meet a professor at the University of Georgia. And I'm thinking, wow, you made it possible for me to even have an opportunity to teach at the University of Georgia or do research at the University of Georgia. But he was very sincere, very genuine, and perhaps one of the most dynamic, but also one of the most authentic persons that I think I ever had the opportunity to meet.
And he took on cases, not just desegregation cases, although that was one of his biggest causes, but he also stepped in to defend African-American clients as well. Tell me about some of the criminal cases in which he argued.
Yes, and just as he was the chief lawyer and activist in cases dismantling segregations in institutions across the state, such as Atlanta Airport and Georgia State University and Georgia, the University of Georgia, he also played a major role. And to quote Mr. King, he was also the man in terms of representing African-American men who were often charged with capital crimes, and I might add often wrongly charged with capital crimes. One of his most famous cases was the Preston Cobb case, where he rescued a 15-year-old boy who had been arrested and convicted and sentenced to electrocution. And Mr. Hollowell and his team were able to rescue him from the electric chair only 5 days before the scheduled electrocution. So there are a number of cases in which Mr. Hollowell represented persons who had been convicted and or charged with very serious crimes, and he was able to rescue them from what at that time was a very racially hostile criminal justice system. And let me just say, however, although he did rescue a number of of those individuals, and he won a number of cases. He was not always successful. There are some cases in which he represented individuals and he was not able to rescue them from that legal system that had convicted them often of crimes in which they did not commit.
You know, I wonder, we talk about Donald Hollowell as an unsung hero, and we've been talking about a number of unsung heroes in recent years of the civil rights movement, the women who maybe didn't make the headlines, the people who sort of stayed out of the spotlight. I wonder why that's important. Why do we need to sort of ferret out all the people who are part of the civil rights movement or made a difference or an impact? Why does that matter?
I think it's critically important, and it matters because social change occurs in our society, in our world, because of the efforts of a wide spectrum of individuals. Certainly, there are charismatic leaders who are important in that social change, but also those individuals who work in the trenches are equally important. And we have a number of social justice issues in which we are facing today in our country and around the world. And I think it's important to study individuals such as Don Hollowell and to look to see how they were effective, not individuals who were always in the headlines and not individuals who were always on TV, but individuals who were working day by day, case by case, helping to, in this case, dismantle discrimination and state segregation throughout our state. So it's equally important to convey to youth and adults today that we certainly need charismatic leaders, but we also need those individuals who are working in the trenches doing sometimes the unglamorous work to help to bring about social change and social justice in our society.
It's Maurice Daniels talking about Donald Hollowell. And he's the founder and director of the Foot Soldier Project for Civil Rights Studies. Maurice, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very kindly.
And that's our show for today. But remember, tomorrow is all about presidential history in Georgia. Who do you think is the best president? Let us know at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Facebook or tweet at us. The show is at OSD Talk. I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.